The international economist Mariana Mazzucato is a voice raised against the dogma of the last 40 or 50 years that governments should sell up, shut up, hand over to business and leave self-interest to steer the economy. She writes, "Much of my work has focused on challenging the outdated economic paradigms that have led us to believe that we are purely self-interested, that value is created by only a few individuals, and that the best a government can do is fix market failures." In best-selling books over the last 10 years, as an advisor to governments and the UN, and as a professor in the economics of innovation and public value at University College London, Mariana Mazzucato has argued that public and private working together can not only solve the biggest problems of our time, but create economies that address the common good. She joins me now. Mariana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
A decent economy that aims for the common good has been the dream of thinkers and politicians and economists from the beginning of time. What's the common good? And how do you think we could actually get there?
Very good question. In fact, how you framed it is very important, that how do we get there is the point of the book. So the new book doesn't say that there's no theories of the common good. The problem is that within economics, it hasn't actually had any impact. So in political philosophy, from Aristotle to Michael Sandel at Harvard, who's a famous communitarian philosopher, they've been debating this whole issue of, if you have a goal, so Aristotle called it the telos, you also need the polis, not the police, but the polity, right? So the community, the how we all relate to each other along the way matters. Democracy, debate, contestation, you know, the whole kind of parliament, if you want, of actually contesting what the good life should be. Whereas in economics, the way we've talked about good is in terms of correcting a problem. It's not an objective. There's no telos. So it's correcting for what we call market failures. So the idea in economics is that the market is the best way to organize our capitalist system, and every now and then it messes up. We call that market failures, and we expect government to come in and fix the problem. So even the concept of the public good, which sounds good, two words, one is good, is just correcting for something the private sector is not doing. So we expect the government to fill the gap. That's why you might hear words like, you know, the financing gap for the sustainable development goals is, you know, whatever it is, $7 trillion. So that idea that there's gaps to fill mean that we literally, at best, you know, at worst, we don't fill the gap. At best, we just put money into things without really thinking how to shape those things, how to shape the money itself. Money's not neutral. The form of finance matters. So the book argues that the fact that we're in this corrective mode in economics around good, as opposed to an objective-oriented system where the how we all relate to each other, capital, labor, public, private, public, public, civil society, matters as much as the what we're trying to do. The fact we don't have that framing means that we will always fail in terms of the good results we are going for, whether it's climate, inequality, biodiversity, water. There's a huge hydrological crisis globally. We are not solving it.
The book, which I should have mentioned before, is the new book, is The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. Mariana, you make the point very vividly in the book that there really is no value without government participation, that government is the basis of innovation. It's not the sole agent, of course, of innovation, but without it, you don't have the kind of development which private enterprise congratulates itself on. Have I got the argument right? And if I have, what recognition do you think government should be given for its role in the creation of value?
So in my first book, The Entrepreneurial State, I made that point. And by the way, the point is not that government is a creator of value. It should be. So, you know, it tends to only be with war. So when we have wars, you never hear of things like the 2030 agenda, right? Governments want to win wars quite quickly. That's why even in COVID, we ended up having wartime tools brought in, like the Defense Production Procurement Act that came from the Korean War was used in the United States to procure personal protection equipment. But in normal times, we have very kind of silly and stupid reactive inertial governments that think that it's it's okay just to subsidize or to have key sectors or to basically just think of a contract as money changing hands from one place to another, whether it's procurement, a public loan, a bailout. So what I argue is that we should learn the lessons from when government takes problems seriously. And unfortunately, those are only related to the military-industrial complex. But if you break down what happened, for example, to get to the moon, that is simply not how we're treating climate change or any of the problems I mentioned before. The first thing Kennedy said was, we're doing it because it's hard, not because it's easy. That's very different from the government speak in most countries. Any white paper you might read talks about facilitating. That means making something easier for someone else. You know, think of a relationship between, you know, a couple. If one is always making something easier for the other one, facilitating, or in economics, de-risking, it's going to be a crappy relationship. You know, one side is going to dominate over the other. So the fact he said, we're doing it because it's hard, not because it's easy, all of a sudden means you need to embrace uncertainty. You need to share risks together. You need to embrace difficulty. Do we have the public service, the civil service that knows how to embrace uncertainty? Or have they been made to fear making any mistake because you'll be in the front page of whatever your newspapers are? In the UK, it's called the Daily Mail, right? So yeah. Whereas venture capitalists are allowed to brag about all the risks they took for, you know, for each success, you have to bear with 8 or 9 failures. Why don't we admit that that's also going to be true for the civil service? So my point is, isn't it weird that government, when it takes a problem seriously, ends up actually fostering huge amounts of innovation? Internet, GPS, touchscreen, Siri, all those things that make our smart products smart and not stupid came from government investments when they had to solve a problem. The internet came about because DARPA, a defense research agency in the Department of Defense, wanted to make sure that the satellites could communicate. GPS came about because the Navy wanted to know where the ships were. Whereas today we just talk about AI, you know, AI for the sake of AI. And actually, if you look at the early history of AI, so early speech recognition, LLM models, they too actually came about when government had problems they had to solve. So what I've been arguing is, A, the history of major technological change has tended to come about through government investments way before the private sector dared to come in. Second, unfortunately, that's only or mainly around military problems. Why can't we do the same kind of ambitious problem solving around areas like climate change, solving problems of how do we build, how do we eat, how do we move, sustainable mobility, and so on, you know, taking it seriously and urgently. And three, when government does actually wake up and do that, it better make sure it's not just socializing risks, but also rewards. What happened in Silicon Valley was that almost all the investments came from government, but then the booty was taken from the private sector. And I'm, of course, not against the private sector. We needed the private sector to get us to the moon. 400,000 people in the private sector across so many industries, aerospace, nutrition, materials, electronics were involved because we had to solve the problems of the astronauts. How would they go to the bathroom? What would they eat? And so on. However, what you had was a very confident public sector that said, here's the problems that need solving. Help us. We're not going to micromanage you, but also you're not going to cheat us. So they put into the contracts no excess profits, which doesn't mean no profits. You don't get to the moon with charity or philanthropy. You need good business, good government, but you don't want to turn it into a gambling machine.
But Mariana, you also make the sort of basic point that if government funding gets a great enterprise off the ground, the government should have a chunk of the action.
Absolutely. And in fact, it does the opposite. It only subsidizes the failures and doesn't then get some of the return. And the example I always give, back in the day, I already started giving the example. Now it's more common knowledge that Tesla itself would never have started without a huge government guarantee scheme, $500 million in a guaranteed loan from the Department of Energy. And that might not sound like a lot of money compared to the trillion that, you know, Elon Musk is making. But this is early stage, high risk, capital intensive phase of the electric vehicle. That's when government stepped in, when the private sector didn't have that money. And how they formulated, though, the loan program made no sense. They said, if you don't pay back the loan, we want 3 million shares in your company. You don't want 3 million shares in a company that doesn't pay back a loan. It's probably not a very good company. Had they said, we're going to get 3 million shares if you're successful after you pay back the loan, the price per share for Tesla between 2009, 2013 went from 9 to 90. That difference, multiplied by 3 million, would have more than paid back the losses in other areas like Solyndra, which was a solar company, got the same amount of money as Tesla, failed, became known for the failure. Everyone blamed government instead of government saying, hey, we got a portfolio, win some, lose some. We're going to make money from some to cover the downside of the others, right? So had they done what I just said, they could have more than paid back the Solyndra loss and the next round of investment. That's what a public venture capital would do. Instead, what they end up doing is socializing risks, privatizing rewards, and just picking up the mess. They picked up the Solyndra mess, and they didn't get a penny out of the Tesla success.
Are there governments in the capitalist West that do that, that take it, cut a reaction?
Yeah, I mean, the examples I gave, I mean, so all these questions are great, but they're like from my first book. So I'm happy to tell you right. more about why the common good is, you know, also a different framing. But in the entrepreneurial state, I gave lots of examples, including, you know, in Israel, quite controversial, given that we know where, you know, why they have so much defense spending. But anyway, Yozma has been critical in Israel. It's a public venture capital fund, which was key to the financing of some of the most important Israeli tech companies. And they've been taking royalties out over history. They actually, I'm not even sure they exist anymore, but anyway, they were fundamental to the Israeli startup scene. Also in Finland, there was Citra, any public bank, of course, right? So BNDS is one of the largest public banks in the world, like KfW in Germany, because they are explicitly a bank and an investment bank, but for the public, then they will, by definition, because that's what banks do, retain equity. However, with public banks, I've written about this recently, the problem is there's huge amounts of money. There's about $23 trillion. It's a lot of money in the national banks, about $2.2 trillion in the multilateral development banks. They're not really that outcomes oriented. They just end up giving money to companies when they're kind of failing to save them. That shouldn't be the role of the public sector. And that's where we come to the common good and the mission book that I wrote two books ago. What I think the public banks should be doing is solving problems, working with companies only if they are willing to help solve the problems. That's why I say move away from a picking winners mentality, which means just picking a sector or a type of firm, towards pick the willing. And if they're small companies, they need extra support, but you don't just give small companies support just because they're small, just like you wouldn't give a large company support just because it's big. So how do you choose the willing that will help you solve, whether it's net zero, biodiversity loss, the hydrological massive problem we have today around water? So working with companies, you know, and helping them work with you through a public loan program, that's a very different remit from just saving a sector, which is what happens in the UK, but also in Italy, where I'm originally from. The bank there, the Cassa Depositi e Prestiti, just gives out money to, say, the steel sector because they're begging for help because they're failing. Whereas in Germany, where I've worked with the KfW, their public bank, their support to the steel sector was conditional that the steel sector invest and innovate and train to reduce the material content of production across the whole supply chain, because Germany actually had a mission around Energiewende.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Mariana Mazzucato, author of The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. Mariana, let's roll forward to the new book. And let me ask you, can we ever agree on what the common good actually is?
So it's a great question. And we should remember that since 2015, every country, including Australia, signed up to the so-called sustainable development goals. You can just remember what they are: no hunger, no poverty, gender parity, life below our oceans, climate action, and so on. So it's not up to me to tell people what the goals are. What I did in the book is to say, for countries that even talk about goals, and of course Australia does talk about different goals, how do we make sure we're not goal washing, common good washing, mission washing? We need a compass that holds us accountable to the common good. And what I do is I built a compass, so five elements. The first is to make sure we are actually explicit. What is the goal? Otherwise, you know, we can all be taken for a ride. What are we actually trying to solve? And how can we make it really clear so that we can also know when we're failing? Can we say yes or no, did we achieve it? Had the space race just said beat the Russian space race, nothing would have happened. They had to turn it into a very clear mission to get to the moon and back in a short amount of time. I already wrote about that in my book, Mission Economy, but the rest is what's new. The second element is co-creation and participation. What should the missions even be? So we can stay at a very high level, you know, these goals, and they are the SDGs. I think they pretty much well capture the big challenges, but how do we transform them on the ground in a city, whether it's in Melbourne, in Perth, in Sydney, to help people actually come together and co-create and make sense and build consensus around the kind of concrete goals. So you might start with climate action, but then you might say what this really means in a city, which maybe is facing poverty, and also you have a lot of kind of just large conglomerates getting all the public contracts. How do you think of missions that make sense to people and have participation? For example, something we worked on in Brazil was making sure that every child in the country had access to healthy, tasty, and sustainable school lunch and breakfast as well. And there was a lot of participation from the schools, from the mothers, and so on. Or in Camden, my part of London, we worked on a mission on adult social care, and we brought the carers who had so much experience, their lived experience on the ground, knowing why the care system did not work. They helped co-create and with true participation, not tokenistic participation, in bringing knowledge on how to do outcomes-oriented adult social care across 10 housing estates, so social housing. Third element is sharing knowledge. There's no point in talking about missions and co-creation if then all the knowledge that we're creating, the learning, the information, the data, gets privatized. So in a world where we like to use big words like collective intelligence, open innovation, innovation ecosystems, the truth is that we are increasingly privatizing knowledge. So we're not turning whether it's our governments, our communities, our ecosystems into learning organizations. And so that's absolutely key. And we saw during COVID how much the knowledge that, you know, was critical for vaccine production was not socialized. In fact, companies like Pfizer completely refused to do it, whereas AstraZeneca was forced to share the knowledge because the publicly financed Oxford University researchers put it as a condition. The fourth element is sharing rewards and examples like the one we just said with the equity deals and so on. And the fifth element is transparency and accountability. Like, if we don't even know who's doing what and why, who's earning what and why, and you have too many consultants in the room and intermediators and so on, then things get so murky and untransparent, it's impossible to govern the system for the common good. So these five elements to me are, how do we hold the common good to account so we don't get common good washing? And personally, I think you have to have each and every one of the elements in place. You can't pick and choose. You can't just do the mission without the co-creation, because also it won't stick. It won't go beyond an electoral cycle because people won't care. You can't have co-creation if then the sharing of the rewards aren't there. What's the point of people, you know, co-creating and participating if they don't get any of the rewards? So I can't think of any one of those elements that shouldn't be there if we use words like common good or public interest, public value, you know, governments working in a mission-oriented way. So for me, this was really about, after I learned how easy it was for my work on both the entrepreneurial state and missions to get sort of captured, and governments would love the words but end up using them as slogans, this to me is to hold governments and business to account when they talk about purpose, missions, and the common good.
But Mariana, I ask again a question I asked early on. I can just see the ranks and ranks of opponents to what you're saying. Those those who want to exploit the system, those who want to profit grossly from the system, et cetera, et cetera. How do you get there? How do you go from an extraordinarily attractive argument to a society that will give its government the authority and the talent to do what you're suggesting?
Again, a great question. And that's actually why I'm quite tired, in the sense that I bust my actually training civil servants globally. It's too easy just to write a book and then to go do a TED talk or to, you know, go on the news, have a great conversation with you, and then, you know, go have a drink. What I've done is I've actually set up a whole institute at UCL, University College London. It's called the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose, where we're literally rewriting the curriculum for civil servants away from this idea that at best they can fix a market failure, And they're just there to redistribute, to facilitate, de-risk, enable, all these really boring words. What does it mean to care about pre-distribution as much as redistribution?
Yes, what now explain that. Explain pre-distribution.
Yeah, I mean, so much of government energy is wasted fixing the mess afterwards, including reducing inequality when we create very unequal systems. That's redistribution, right? Through tax. You want progressive taxation. Well, if there's a progressive government, you have a progressive government. I'm assuming for this part of the conversation, we're assuming that redistribution is even seen as something important. And of course it is. However, it's too late. If one continues to allow what happened again in Silicon Valley, socialization of risk, privatization of rewards, which then allow the tech companies to earn the huge rents. I use the word rents and not profits, because rents are excess profits, earning in excess of what you've actually done. Then it's very hard to actually redistribute back to the fair share, given what everyone did. If instead we do pre-distribution, which means how we create value from the start, has the right level of wages, the right amount of money going into the public coffers, given the public sector risk-taking, the right amount of, again, co-creation from local communities. I've worked a lot with indigenous communities, traditional peoples in the Amazon and Brazil, and they say, can you please stop condescendingly just create something like the Amazon Fund, which sounds great, like you're going to do things for us. We should be at the table designing and governing that fund. And I give also examples from Australia in the book where there's similar issues. So how do you get that participatory co-creation, sharing knowledge, sharing rewards? These are all ways to pre-distribute those parts of the elements I talked about before. So we at least minimize the level of inequality, not just in income, but also in voice, that we have ex post. So we don't have to waste so much time. But coming back to your excellent question, that requires training. I often joke that I come in as an economist and I walk out as a therapist, because it also requires confidence, literally the confidence. If government has no confidence and is just bullied constantly from the Pfizers of the world, but it shouldn't, you know, it's not just Pfizer, it's a lot of the tech companies too that are saying, oh, if you, you know, change the rules and have more regulation, or in different sectors, you know, influence how the intellectual property rights scheme is structured, then we're going to leave. If governments can actually get together, especially the so-called coalition of the willing, so different types of progressive governments really thinking together these issues of pre-distribution, then we can also start learning how to do this better. But the training that we provide is literally at the level of, what is government even for? What is collective value creation? What's a creative bureaucracy instead of an inertial bureaucracy? Yeah. How do we get that flexibility, the agility that they had to get to the moon and back? They had to change their whole bureaucracy inside NASA because they realized that they were very siloed between departments. And I tell that story in Mission Economy, which was quite tragic. It was actually one of the astronauts who died in one of the Apollo programs. His name was Gus Grissom. While he was burning to death in the lunar module, he said, how the, swear word, will we ever get to the moon if we can't even talk between two or three buildings? Because they literally couldn't hear what was being said in Mission Control Room. And on the back of that, NASA literally changed how it organized its internal organization to be more, you know, different project managers, each with their high-level delegated teams, but in constant communication with each other. So that kind of agility, flexibility. We're currently actually developing an index through the Institute called the Public Sector Capability Index. It's a program funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies, working with over 1,000 cities, trying to better understand also at the super local level, what are the capabilities, the capacities that mayors and their teams require to work in an outcomes-oriented way to solve problems, whether it's floods, droughts, but also, you know, organizing the Olympics or a carnival in Rio.
Yes.
What are the dynamic capabilities, not the static cost-benefit analysis, net present value, which would have never gotten us to the moon had they done a cost-benefit analysis of that.
Mariana, I know that tax is an important part of your argument, and we haven't got time to go into it in much detail, but there is one point I would like to ask you about, because it matters politically very much in Australia at the moment, where we're going through modest tax reform. It is said that tax kills innovation. Do you see evidence for that?
First of all, that doesn't mean anything, because there's so many different taxes, right? So there's
but if you raise the taxes,
No. Okay, so put it this way, just even empirically. In the year that both NASA, right, and DARPA formed, these are two organizations I mentioned during the course of the interview, the top marginal taxation rate under general Republican President Eisenhower, okay, was over 90%. That's the top marginal rate. So not the total rate, obviously, the top marginal rate. So that is the same year that the U.S. was in probably one of its most innovative kind of periods in history. Obviously, that doesn't mean that's what we should do now. That just means let's actually look at history, get proper evidence. What we know is that what you need tax for is especially to incentivize behavior in the right direction. So, for example, if you have a capital gains tax where the time that the investment has to be made in order to get a capital gains tax reduction is too low, then you're basically fostering short-termism. And what you need in order to actually drive long-term investments, and almost all the examples we've given so far, internet, nanotech, biotech, clean tech, AI, have required patient long-term capital. What you require is a tax system that rewards that patience. Or if we want a greener economy, you want to make sure that we're not currently taxing labor more than we're taxing the material content, as in many countries is the case. Corporate income tax, by the way, most companies actually don't even pay that. They, you know, most incomes of the large, you know, executive managers, for example, they're paid in stock options. That's precisely why we need to make sure that capital gains tax is working well, because otherwise we're allowing so much of the income earned through stock options. Elon Musk's whole income is basically through stock options. If capital gains tax is too low, we're allowing a very extractive form of economy. But this isn't about high tax, low tax. It's how do you have within the tax base a smart taxation system that is stimulating innovation, right? And just having tax really, really low doesn't stimulate innovation, that stimulates inequality. Warren Buffett is not known for his communist tendencies, and he said, "Can please stop reducing my tax. That's only increasing inequality." He said, "I invest when I see an opportunity." So the real issue is what can governments do using both taxes, but also all their levers, which include procurement, which is often 20% of a government's spending, to really kind of catalyze the sense that there's opportunities, that there's new markets, that there's new technologies out there. And that ultimately is what stimulates good business investment. If businesses are just trying to come in and leave, that's when they just care about tax, right? Because they don't care anything about the real economy in a particular place. They just want to go in and out quickly. That is not the kind of business you want to be attracting. If you want innovative businesses who come and stay and help form a whole innovative ecosystem, let me give you an example. Denmark, which is tiny, is today the number one supplier of high-tech green digital services to China. And the way that particular kind of innovative green digital service economy formed was through Copenhagen, the city, wanting to be the greenest city in the world. They used all their levers on the demand side to help the startups scale up. They scaled up. They worked with their national champion, also Vestas, a large renewable energy company. And between both servicing the city on the digital side of sustainable mobility, sustainable housing, and so on, and working also with this large national champion, they ended up forming this amazingly innovative economy that now is servicing China's $5 trillion attempt to reduce the material content of production across the whole manufacturing base to reduce pollution, which is huge there. So that didn't come about because they had low tax. Look at the tax in Denmark. It is not low. It came about because they were very smart in how they used all their different levers, from subsidies, tax incentives, procurement, and so on. But any country that says, or any business that is saying, if you reduce tax, you'll kill innovation, is just dogma. It's not true. But what you want is also not the opposite. You don't want to just increase tax. That's also not smart. You need to really be thinking through the different types of tax policies that can help shape the market to be more innovative, more sustainable, and definitely more inclusive.
Mariana, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much.
I've been talking to Mariana Mazzucato, author of many books arguing what we've been discussing tonight, but most recently, The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. And Professor Mazzucato is in the University College London, where she heads the Economics of Innovation and Public Value.